to talk about it more offline here if you want, but I believe that verse 21, although most modern American commentators and translations render that to say, if you can gain your freedom, you should do that instead of remaining a slave, I think that a better translation is, even if you can gain your freedom, rather remain employed as a slave. As I've surveyed various Bible commentators, the ones that were not so close to the time of the war between the states and America, the ones that had a little distance from that, all agree with this, no, stay a slave. The ones that wrote right around the time of the Civil War seemed to think that it had to do with becoming emancipated. But the reason why I think he's saying remain a slave is it fits with the application he has, remain in the position in which you're called. Marriage is another calling of sorts. If you were married when you became a Christian, by all means stay married. And he encourages people who were unmarried when they became a Christian to seriously consider remaining single. The point is to keep walking in the way that God has called you. And then in the fourth sermon, we looked at three issues, kind of external issues to consider and whether or not to get married. One was external circumstances and stress. Paul calls it a necessity or distress or crisis in verse, I think it's 26. And I believe he was speaking of persecution that was going to be coming to the Christians there in Corinth. And I think he's saying, look, persecution is not a valid reason to get a divorce, but it is a valid reason to consider delaying marriage, getting married. He also mentions the temporary nature of this world in verses 29 through 31. It says the time has been shortened. And although there's a number of ways to apply that, and commentators are all over the map, I applied it particularly in terms of life on earth has been shortened by the fall of into sin. Human life will end, marriage will end in heaven, our possessions will all be burned up in the end. Whatever we do then must contribute to God's eternal purposes. Whatever we do with the temporary things of this world, even getting marriage, should be to further God's purpose in this world. We also looked at the distracting cares and responsibilities of this world as a consideration for whether or not to get married. Paul says a married man is responsible to provide food and clothing and shelter and love to his wife. Unmarried people, he says in verse 32, are more free to care for the things of the Lord. And we focused on how can we unclutter our lives and use what God has given us to glorify Him. Last week, then, we looked at decisive factors regarding marriage. If these things are true, then go for it. Get married. Will it bring an end to disorderly conduct? Go for it. Are you of age? Go for it. Is the marriage appropriate? Go for it. Do you have parental permission? Go for it. Then when you marry, marry in the Lord and marry until death parts. That was last week. Now this week I want to end with his thoughts on singleness, and mostly in verse 37. And I want to open this just with a story. As I've been studying to teach church history next week, I read about a man by the name of John of Montecorvino. He was born in the 1200s A.D., He was one of the first European missionaries to reach China with the gospel. You think about the distance that he had to travel, and around the year 1300, it was even before that, it was 1290s, to get from Italy all the way to Beijing, China. The incredible logistics that it would have taken for him to get, I mean, this was 200 years before Columbus crossed the Atlantic Ocean, and that was, Columbus's journey was a lot shorter than what John of Monte Corvino did. It was such a difficult journey that his traveling partner died halfway there. They went to India first, and then the normal sea journey would be then from India on up around to the east coast of China. On the way there, while in India, John baptized 100 people, he said, and then made this long, arduous journey up to Beijing. There in China, he learned the language. He translated the entire New Testament and the Psalms. He witnessed to tens of thousands of people, including the emperor himself. He built two monasteries. He cared for 150 children who lived under his roof. And he did all this as a single man, by himself, with no help. He wrote a letter to the Pope at the age of 58, reporting on his progress and asking for helpers. The Pope sent seven men out to help him. Three of those men died along the way. The journey was so difficult. This is the kind of calling that a married man could not do very well. Even hundreds of years later, when missionaries like William Carey and Hudson Taylor and John Peyton left, their wives died fairly quickly on the mission field. Conditions were just very difficult. They didn't have transcontinental plane flights and whatever, all the things that we have today in our modern world to make travel and life in a foreign country easier, as including the medical drugs and stuff we have to combat disease. What does it take for a person like John of Monte Corvino to know if he's cut out for life as a single man? Paul gives four decisive factors here in verse 37. The first one is stand steadfast or firmly established or firmly settled in his heart and mind. There's a transition here from verse 36 where Paul says what he wishes to do, let them marry, to verse 37, he who stood fast in his heart to keep his own virginity or his own virgin. The subject, he who is steadfast or firm or immovable, comes from a Greek word that means to sit. He is firmly seated and nothing's going to budge him. I was working on a leaky faucet 2 weeks ago, and I figured that the leak came from a leaky valve seat, a little O-shaped piece of rubber that the valve sits on and stops the flow of water in the sink. And you can usually unscrew the just under the handle and the whole valve comes out and you can replace that little rubber ring. So I got out my I sent Josh in there to I instructed him how to do it, and he said, I can't do it. I can't get the thing to unscrew. And I said, oh, good grief. I'll show you how to do it. And I grabbed the pliers, and I couldn't get that thing to budge. And he grabbed my teeth, and I couldn't. I don't remember if we used WD-40 or something. We were trying to get that thing, and the little, the thumb threads were all shaving off as we did that, and it was just, we could not get that thing to budge. It was steadfast and immovable. I ended up having to remove the whole faucet and replace it with a whole new one because I could not change the valve. I could not get that thing to budge. The verb here, in the Greek, is in the perfect tense. It's the Greek word for stand, implying that it has stood for a long time and continues to stand today. the idea has entered into his heart or mind some time ago, and it has not changed over time. It remains established. The matter has been settled for some time in his mind. So here is the first decisive factor mentioned in favor of choosing a life of celibacy, and that is a deeply seated, time-tested conviction. John of Montecorvino did not start his career as a missionary. He started out as a soldier. As a single man, living on his own, traveling, fighting, he knew what it took and had some idea of what it would take to lead the life of a missionary. And over those years as a soldier, his resolve was established, and he knew he could live as a single man and do great things for the Lord when God called him to take the gospel to the ends of the earth. Men like him are a great example of steadfastness. The second decisive factor here is having no necessity, no constraint, no compulsion. This is the same word that Paul used back in verse 26 to the current necessity or the current crisis or distress. Paul says there shouldn't be this. There shouldn't be this a lack that's limiting your options and forcing you to choose this life. There may be outside pressures such as persecution or a war that call for delaying marriage, but a lifelong commitment to stay single should not be made on the basis of outside factors, but should be a conviction from inside your heart. It shouldn't come from other people pressuring you to make a decision. And the situation I think that was going on in Corinth was that there were these ascetics that were telling the people in Corinth it's better not to get married. You'll be more spiritual if you stay away. And so even you married people, you probably ought to get a divorce, and then you'll be more spiritual. Paul doesn't want people making a decision based on that kind of outside pressure. Likewise, we should not be swayed by other people's opinions or criticisms. Likewise, from the perspective of a father, as I said last week, I believe this passage is actually primarily directed to fathers. Outside forces should not be the main reason for marrying your son or daughter off. Just because you're running low on money doesn't mean it's time to marry your daughter off and get a dowry and have one less mouth to feed. Or just because you can't afford to pay for a wedding isn't a reason to say, no, you can't get married right now, if it's best for your daughter to marry. Now, most of us have not experienced that kind of poverty, but it is a big issue throughout the world. Every year, this year alone, 1 million fathers will sell their daughters into sexual slavery. This year alone. And it is estimated that 50,000 of those children or young women will be sold as slaves into the United States this year alone. If a daughter and her parents have agreed upon a course of singleness for her, they must have the fortitude to resist the temptation to change course when external circumstances get bad. Third issue, having power, authority, or control over his own will or his own desire. If applied to fathers, this phrase in 37 may be speaking of the authority that they have in the matter. In chapter 9, Paul uses the same word, power, authority, control. He uses this to describe the authority that he could have exercised as an apostle to tell them, the people in Corinth, to give their tithe money to him so that he could work full-time as a minister rather than having to work at making tents to earn his own money. He had the authority to receive tithe money from them, but he didn't use that authority, he says. Likewise, a father has a place of authority in his daughter's life. She's not under the authority of her pastor or her boyfriend or anybody else. The father, as a proper authority, should be involved in her decision-making. If he's not supportive of a choice of celibacy, it would be wise not to set your heart against him on that course. This word authority or power also parallels the word in verse 36 that's translated, it must be or has to be or ought to be. Here it could be worded, do you have the authority to do as you please when it comes to deciding that you'll remain single? This applies to the virgin under consideration. In many cultures, a daughter isn't free to decide who she wants to marry. She doesn't have the authority to make that decision. There are even some men I've met that don't feel like they have the freedom to be single because they're, the only child, and they feel an obligation to carry on the family name. The most common interpretation of this phrase, however, focuses on self-control. Do you have the self-control to follow through on a commitment to stay single? Do you have the strength of authority over your own desires to keep walking free from sexual sin? If no, then verse 9 applies. Better to marry than to burn. If the answer is yes, I have both the steadfast desire to serve God as a single, I have the authority and self-discipline to do it, then God may well use you to do great things for Him in your lifetime. He may use you to go to a very dangerous field and protect other people's lives. So far we've looked at three decisive factors concerning the choice to remain single. You have a track record of consistency. Are there outside factors that would keep you from doing it? And do you have the authority and willpower to follow through? The fourth and last one here has to do with how well thought through the decision is. I see this in the phrase, he's judged or determined or decided in his heart. And the NIV says he's made up his mind. The last occurrence of this Greek word, judged or determined or decided, was at the beginning of chapter 6, where it was used of the work of a judge in a civil court. It was also used in chapter 5 to describe the process of judging whether or not a person's actions are consistent with Christianity and making decisions about church discipline. In chapter 2, verse 2, Paul said that he had been through a similar deliberative and decisive process where he determined he would know nothing among the Corinthians but Jesus Christ and Him crucified. This same kind of deliberation ending in a decisive conclusion, like a judgment handed down at the end of a trial after it's been deliberated, this is what parents and their adult children need to go through before settling upon a life of singleness. During my years as a missionary recruiter, I traveled around the country attending lots of different mission conferences. And one of the things that made me a little worried was how often you'd have this situation of a conference. By the end of the conference, you've got all these sleep-deprived college kids, and get them hyped up on worship music, and they're all out of their chairs and singing, and then you have a powerful altar call at the end and talk about the tremendous needs of the world, and come sign here, say you're going to be a missionary, and they come flooding down the aisle and sign commitment cards, and I think it's great to, of course, I mean, that's what I was giving my life to, was recruiting missionaries, but over time I realized, maybe half of the people that signed those cards would actually try it out on a short-term missions trip. Maybe 10% of the people that signed those cards would actually end up on the mission field. And half of the people that end up on the mission field would not make it through even their first 4 years. They'd come home because they couldn't hack it on the field. The decision to become a missionary shouldn't be a snap decision that's been emotionally worked up. Because not everybody's cut out for that. It needs to be a well-considered decision. And marriage and singleness should be the same way. They need to be well-considered decisions, not snap decisions made on the spur of the moment or due to a strong emotion. So there we have these four decisive considerations for living a life of singleness. And as I looked through this, I had to struggle myself. I want to see all my kids get married and have grandkids and have millions of great grandchildren. But I had to struggle as I read through this myself. As a father, am I willing to encourage my own one of my own children? If God's calling is on their life to be single, am I willing to support that? As I studied this, I realized I need to be open to that. I need to be open to that possibility of God's work in my children's lives. But it still seems strange to me, this whole section. It seems like the entire chapter is biased in favor of celibacy, and that has been a struggle for me too. I'm not sure that how do you put this together? Three thoughts. One is Paul does not demean marriage in this chapter. He upholds it consistently. Verse 2, let each man have his own wife. Verse 5, don't deprive each other, speaking to married couples. Verse 7, he implies that marriage is a gift from God. Verse 10, a wife must not separate from her husband, nor a husband from his wife. Verse 17, he calls marriage a calling from God in which couples should continue walking. In verse 28, he says, even if you don't take my advice and you get married anyway, you still have not sinned. And verse 36, let them marry. Verse 38, the one who gives his own virgin in marriage does well, he says. So we must understand that this chapter is not an anti-marriage chapter. That's the first point. One of the commentators I read put it well. Paul rejected unqualified asceticism in favor of practical considerations. Paul not only adopts an anti-ascetic stance towards the Corinthians ascetics, who said nobody should get married, you'll be more spiritual if you're single, but he also is concerned pastorally to release those who wish to marry from any sense of sin and failure or second-class status. He refuses to allow those ascetics to regard themselves as elites. God's demands remain diverse for different people in different situations. Yet we do have to deal with the fact that Paul is clearly encouraging Corinthians to consider those who are unmarried to remain single. Verse 37, he that keeps his virgin, doesn't marry her off, will do well. He uses the same word well or good to commend singleness in verses 1 and 8 and 26. And he says in verse 38, he who does not give her in marriage will do better. And verse 4, she'll be happier if she remains thus. Thus being the last condition that Paul described, which was a woman released from the bonds of marriage by her husband's death. So he clearly is encouraging singles in Corinth to remain single. Why? One reason that might be to look at another passage where he instead commands these young widows to get married. He does that in 1 Timothy chapter 5. He encourages widows who are under the age of 60 to remarry. Verse 11, refuse younger widows' requests, and that's their request for financial support and return for service to the church. Refuse those requests for financial support. For when they have grown lustful away from Christ they desire to marry, and they get condemnation because they have rejected their first pledge. Moreover, they learn to be idle, going about from house to house, not only idle, but tattlers and busybodies, speaking things which they ought not to. I desire, therefore, that the younger widows marry and bear children and rule the household and give no occasion to the adversary for reviling, for some have already turned aside after Satan. So one thing to consider is, why did he say these widows should get married when he said the Corinthians shouldn't? Well, the reasons he gives in 1 Timothy 5 is he's seeing, and these widows that Timothy is serving in Ephesus, a temptation to leave their faith in Jesus and become attracted to men that will take their attention away from Jesus as single women. And so he says, let them get married to Christian men so they won't be tempted away from faith in Jesus. The other issue he said there with the widows in Ephesus that he advises Timothy about, he said if they don't get married, they're going to have a problem with idleness and becoming busybodies. If they get married, then they will be able to engage with wholesome activities that that will keep them out of trouble, basically. Get married, bear children, rule their household. So, in a situation where a single is not being tempted to leave the faith and is able to stay well engaged with meaningful activity, these exhortations to Timothy are not going to hold as much weight. And there may be a good reason to encourage people who are strong in their faith and who are busy about the things of God to, hey, stay on that course, stay single, keep doing that, keep following Christ and keep doing things for Him. Other reasons Paul encourages people toward singleness. Verses 1, 8, 26, 37, he says, it is good. There's nothing wrong with singleness. It is a good course. It was Paul's choice in life. And he says, I wish all men could be as I am, in verse 7. In verse 8, I'd be good for them if they were to remain as I am. And as a married man myself, I recommend marriage. I think it's great. It's only natural to recommend the way of life that you're enjoying. And Paul does that. He's enjoying the way of life that God has given him, and so he recommends it. Another reason to encourage singleness is it is a gift and a calling. Paul has said in verse 7, each has his own gift from God, speaking of singleness versus marriage. Verse 17, he talks about the Lord apportioning these gifts to each, and as God has called, thus he should keep walking. If God has called you to live a single life and serve Him, then you need to accept that as a gift from Him and engage in the calling that He called you to do. If God's calling you to be single, then it's only right and appropriate to accept that calling and that gift and run with it. Circumstances are another reason that Paul encouraged them towards singleness. In this case, he talks in verse 26 about a current necessity and verse 29 about the time being short, the order of this world passing away in verse 31. There may be special circumstances that would be very difficult for a married person to serve the Lord in. That'd be better for a single person. I think of some of the missionary assignments that some of my friends are on, in war zones and very difficult places of the world. Whereas singles, they're able to engage it better than a married couple can. Singleness is an easier life with fewer responsibilities and more freedom. Paul says that. Married people are going to have stress, he says in verse 28. I want it to be easy for you, he says in verse 28. Verse 32, I want you to be free from cares. The unmarried man cares about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. Verse 34, the unmarried woman and virgin cares for the things of the Lord in order that she might be holy in body and spirit. She'd be happier. Verse 40. Life as a single person really is easier. It may be hard for some of you who have not been married to imagine that. But it is. There are fewer responsibilities. You have less that you're responsible for, and that is a state that you can enjoy and use. But Paul never commands singleness in this chapter. He's offering advice. He's offering spirit-led advice, as verse 40 bears out. The way Paul turns that last phrase, I think I also have the Spirit of God, is perhaps a bit of irony where there were false teachers, these ascetics that were coming in and saying, the Spirit of God says that you will be more holy if you divorce your wife and you live a single life. Paul says, I think I too have the Spirit of the Lord. He is teaching with the authority of the Holy Spirit. John Calvin summed it up by saying that the whole discussion amounts to this. Celibacy is better than marriage because it has more liberty, so that persons can serve God with greater freedom. But at the same time, no necessity ought to be imposed so as to make it unlawful for individuals to marry if they think it proper. And further, that marriage itself is a remedy appointed by God for our infirmity, which all ought to use that are not endowed with the gift of celibacy. Is God calling you or your children to a life of dedicated service to God as a single person? Don't miss out on a special gift. Judge wisely. Consider the calling that Paul, the Apostle Paul, lived out. Consider the calling that the missionary, John of Monte Corvino, lived out. Let me close with a letter that John wrote to the Pope. He said, in this mission, I abode alone and without any associate for 11 years. I built a church in this city of Cambalec, in which the king has his chief residence. I completed that 6 years ago. I put a bell tower in it and put three bells in. I baptized there, as well as I can estimate up to this time, some 6,000 persons. Also, I've gradually bought 150 boys, the children of pagan parents, of ages varying from 7 to 11. Can you imagine 150 boys between 7 and 11 in your house? They had never learned any religion before. I've written out psalters for them, 30 hymnaries and 2 breviaries. By help of these, 11 of these boys already know how to lead worship services, and they've formed a choir, and they take their weekly turn of duty, whether I'm there or not. Many of the boys are also employed in writing out psalters and other things suitable. His Majesty the Emperor delights much to hear them singing. I have the bells rung at the canonical hours, and with my congregation of babes and sucklings, I perform divine worship, and the chanting we do by ear, the singing, because I have no service books with notes. Indeed, if I had but 2 or 3 comrades to aid me, it's possible that the Emperor Kam would have been baptized by this time. I ask then for such brethren to come, if any are willing to come, such, I mean, as will make it their business to lead exemplary lives. As for the road hither, I may tell you that the way through the land of the Goths, subject to the emperor of the northern Tatars, is the shortest and safest. By it those friars might come in 5 or 6 months. The other route is very long and very dangerous, involving 2 sea voyages. But, on the other hand, the first mentioned route hasn't been open for a considerable time on account of the wars that have been going on. But as far as I ever saw or heard or tell, I do not believe any king or prince in the world can be compared to His Majesty the Khan in respect to the extent of his dominions and the vastness of their population or the amount of his wealth. Here I'll stop. Dated January 8, 1305.